There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hello, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is TKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Pilar Steers.
I'm Melody Bukito.
And I'm Sophie Ho.
Today we broadcast from Geogeagay, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe nations. The time now is 5 p.m.
Today we've got some headlines discussing Quebec's possible fossil fuel extraction policy changes, Queer McGill's launching of their zine, COVID-19 updates in Quebec and Ontario, as well as the recent gun violence in Montreal.
Following that, we have our main segment, an audio essay discussing the Taliban's recent takeover of Afghanistan. To preface this, we'd like to emphasize that this topic is extremely expansive and complex, and we can in no way cover every element in detail in the time we have. That being said, this conflict has been ongoing for the past 20 years, with its roots spanning decades before that, continuing to impact people today, so we thought it important to cover what we can to the best of our ability on the show. Today, we're going to give a condensed overview of the past and current political climates in Afghanistan, as well as U.S. involvement in the war.
We would like to issue a content warning for the headline discussing gun violence, as well as our audio essay on the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. We'll be right back with headlines after a short music break.
Thank you. train of thought facing the elevator in an awkward way. Everyone drunk off of their faces, just singing our praises, wanting in on the magic, say. Midnight on the second floor counting, while you were in the corner joking about how it would be your last, how it would be your last. While we were outside having a smoke, I heard you asking around, hey, could you find me some coke? Every year is just a little bit darker, then the darker gets darker, then it's dark as hell. By now you don't need a good reason, you climb up to the highest of trees, and you left yourself clean. Yeah, you left yourself clean. I shut feet quick, really feeling ecstatic. Feelings come and they go, someplace little high, big lows. In any case, a good friend is a good friend, no doubt. Sometimes a good friend ain't enough to grab you and pull you up. Damn the work, damn the music, damn the fun that's missing. Of a train of thought facing the elevator in an awkward way. Made a call from the side room. Hey, Mike, can I come home soon? I'm lying on the floor in the bathroom. I've had it with this place. We're all going insane. Had it with this place. Well, you've been feeling lost now, living in the background, hanging with the rough crowd, thinking of the times you had it all figured out. Now everyone is passed out, blurry on the edge now. As an effigy waiting to come down. I've had it with this place. We're all going insane. I've had it with this place. We've all gone insane.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Old Friends by Jane's Party, followed by Damn by Ada Lee.
Now it's time for our weekly headline roundup. In recent news, the Quebec government is currently considering ending all fossil fuel extraction in the province. According to an article by the Montreal Gazette, there was a recent, quote, legal challenge to Quebec's Petroleum Resources Act and regulations related to the Galt project near Gaspé was one factor in the decision, unquote. Jonathan Julien, Quebec's Minister of Energy and Natural Resources, said that he, quote, refused to authorize the project because of risks to the aquatic environment, unquote. There will be a court ruling on the challenge against this in the following months. Depending on this ruling, there's a possibility of ending fossil fuel extraction in the province, according to Julien.
According to the Montreal Gazette, Julien did not comment on how companies who have permits for extraction will be treated. However, he did say there would be compensation depending on certain factors. Julien said, quote, "If the effect of this decision is that the law and regulations are not well adapted, we'll have to react. So we are currently protecting ourselves with concrete analysis, and it's true that we're looking at all the scenarios. Everything is on the table, including banning exploitation and exploration of gas," unquote. He also spoke to the possibility of banning gas or oil pipelines being, quote, "consistent with the reality of 2021," unquote.
After a year of online classes at McGill, as student services are reopening, Queer McGill prepares to reopen as well. Queer McGill is a student-run service created in 1972. It provides queer students with a variety of resources and advocates for queer student rights at McGill and beyond. Cal Pease, coordinator of Queer McGill, spoke about the role of the organization in an interview with McGill Daily, saying that, quote, "We work with the Gender and Sexuality Commissioner to focus on improving the queer student experience at McGill and within the SSMU," unquote. The administrative coordinator of the organization also sits on multiple committees advocating for queer students, such as the McGill Joint Board Senate Committee on Equity, Subcommittee on Queer People, which has spoken out about speaking events harmful to trans and non-binary youth, as well as hosted many workshops for queer students. On August 29th, Queer McGill launched their summer zine. If you're interested in giving it a look, it is accessible through their website and Facebook page. It features art pieces done by students, as well as updates, resources, and events that Queer McGill offers. Some of these resources include safer sex supplies, gender-affirming gear, and menstrual supplies. To request resources, students can fill out a resource reservation form found on Queer McGill's website. Go check out Queer McGill's summer zine and get ready for some events they're offering soon, like a virtual escape room on November 13th.
This past Wednesday, September 15th, Quebec reported 785 more positive tests for COVID-19, with around 74% coming from those unvaccinated. There was one additional death reported this week, meaning there are now 11,313 reported deaths in the province. 46 more people checked into hospitals in the province for COVID-19, and 26 were discharged, meaning hospitalizations rose by 20 for a total of 250. According to Quebec's health ministry, within these 46 patients, 14 were double-vaxxed more than a week ago, and 30 of them were completely unvaccinated. The intensive care ward saw an increase of 7 patients, meaning out of the 250 hospitalized patients, 85 are in an ICW. In exciting news, 16,123 more doses of vaccines have been administered, adding to the total of 12,666,616 doses that have been administered in Quebec. Ontario reported 593 new COVID-19 cases last Wednesday, the second straight day with cases under 600. 348 of these cases came from people unvaccinated, 44 partially vaccinated people, and 146 fully vaccinated people, with the remainder having unknown vaccination status. The majority of these cases came from Toronto, Peel Region, Ottawa, and Windsor, Essex. Overall, the Ontario Health Ministry has reported 9,629 deaths. In terms of vaccination in Ontario, there are more than 10.2 million people fully immunized with 2 doses. This is 78.4% of the eligible 12 and older population. 346 people are reported to be in general hospital wards with COVID-19, with 188 patients in intensive care units. In good news, 560,824 Ontario residents were reported to have recovered from COVID-19, which is about 97% of known cases.
There has been an increase in gun violence in Montreal since the summer. On August 2nd, 3 people were killed in Rivière-des-Prairies. This is one of many incidences of gun violence that occurred over the summer. On that day, 5 people were targeted, 2 of which survived. Last Tuesday, September 14th, a man was shot and killed in Laval. At 2:30 a.m., the police said that several people called because they heard gunshots. As a result of the escalating gun violence, the Montreal police are receiving increased funding of $5.5 million to, quote, hire more officers and civilian aides, unquote. However, police intervention usually comes after the violent crime has already taken place, going towards investigation of the crime. Speaking to the situation of police funding for instances of violent crime, defundthepolice.org says rather than increasing funding for the police, funds should be invested into, quote, other sectors to carry out investigations, social workers, sociologists, forensic scientists, doctors, researchers, and other well-trained individuals to fulfill our needs when violent crimes take place, unquote. That was our weekly headline roundup. Now we've got some tunes followed by our audio essay.
Just trouver un oasis, trouver la sortie. Mais la distance en fond, le désert.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Outsider Unusual by Alicia Clara, followed by Dessert by Le Couleur. Now we will be playing our audio essay on the Taliban's recent takeover in Afghanistan, first starting out by giving a simplified timeline of the conflict over the past 20 years, then delving into the current situation in Afghanistan and the implications of this takeover. 5 days ago marked 1 month since the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, shortly after President Biden withdrew U.S. and allied troops from the country. Taliban militants seized control of Kabul, the capital. In order to understand how the Taliban took over, we think it's important to understand the history of politics in Afghanistan and what was occurring in the country decades before the Taliban was even started. So we will now start with discussing the political history of the region.
The land that is now Afghanistan has a very interesting and long history of domination by foreign conquerors and animosity among internal groups causing constant battles. In 1921, the British were defeated in the Third British-Afghan War, and Afghanistan became an independent nation. In 1926, the Sovereign of Afghanistan, Amir Aminullah Khan, declared Afghanistan a monarchy. Not long after proclaiming himself king, critics' frustrations with his new policies took up arms in 1928, and a year later, the king abdicated and left the country. With a new king, Zahir Shah, bringing stability to the country for 40 years, the United States formally recognized Afghanistan in 1934. In 1953, Muhammad Khan, cousin of the king, became prime minister and looked to Pakistan, a communist nation, for economic and military assistance. He also introduced a number of social reforms, including allowing women a more public presence. By 1957, he allowed women to attend university and enter the workforce. In 1973, Khan overthrew the king in a military coup, and Khan's regime, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, came to power. He abolished the monarchy and named himself president. The Republic of Afghanistan was established and formed strong ties with the USSR. By 1977, Khan had proposed a new constitution that granted women's rights and worked to modernize the largely communist state. He also forced many suspected of not supporting him out of the government. In 1978, Khan was killed in a communist coup. Nur Muhammad Taraki, one of the founding members of the Afghan Communist Party, took control as president, and Babril Karmal was named deputy prime minister. Together, they proclaimed independence from Soviet influence and declared their policies based on Islamic principles, Afghan nationalism, and socioeconomic justice. The rivalry between Taraki and Hafizullah Amin, another influential communist leader, leads to fighting between the two sides. In 1979, after the American ambassador was killed, the United States cut off assistance to Afghanistan. Also during this year, a power struggle between Taraki and Amin began, and Taraki was killed in a confrontation with Amin supporters. The USSR invaded Afghanistan to help the faltering communist regime, and Amin and multiple of his followers were executed, and Karmal became president. A widespread opposition to Karmal and the Soviets spawned violent public demonstrations. By 1980, rebels united against Soviet invaders, and the USSR backed Afghan Ardi. Amidst this war, about 20 million Afghans fled from the war to Pakistan and 1.5 million to Iran. In 1984, Saudi Islamist Osama bin Laden made his first documented trip to Afghanistan to aid anti-Soviet fighters. The UN investigated and reported human rights violations in Afghanistan. In 1995, newly formed Islamic militia, the Taliban rose to power on promises of peace. Most Afghans, exhausted by years of drought, famine, and war, approved of the Taliban for upholding traditional Islamic values. However, the U.S. refused to recognize the authority of the Taliban. In 1997, the Taliban publicly executed a former Afghanistan politician who served as the General Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. In 1998, following al-Qaeda's bombing of two American embassies in Africa, President Clinton ordered cruise missile attacks against bin Laden's training camps in Afghanistan. The attacks missed the leaders of the terrorist group. In 2000, by now considered an international terrorist, bin Laden was widely believed to be hiding in Afghanistan, cultivating thousands of followers in terrorist training camps. The U.S. demanded that bin Laden be surrendered to stand trial for the embassy bombings, but the Taliban declined the surrender. The United Nations punished Afghanistan with sanctions restricting trade and economic development.
The reason for the initial invasion of the United States stemmed from an al-Qaeda attack on the United States. As a rebuttal and part of Operation Enduring Freedom, George W. Bush instigated the initial invasion of Afghanistan. In December of 2001, many leaders of al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden, had fled to Pakistan, the beginnings of Pakistan becoming somewhat of a safe haven for Taliban fighters. The same month, the Taliban spokesman offered an unconditional surrender, which was rejected by the United States. The attention of the United States and NATO changed to rebuilding and establishing a Western-style democracy in Afghanistan. At first, they succeeded with the government being installed and new infrastructure built, such as schools and hospitals. Girls and women who had previously been barred from education under the rule of the Taliban were able to go to college and join the workforce. However, there was a high amount of corruption in the government. By 2003, many of the American troops' efforts were shifted over to the war in Iraq. Over time, the Taliban were able to rebuild their forces, leading to President Obama deploying thousands more troops to Afghanistan. In May of 2011, a U.S. Navy SEAL team killed Osama bin Laden, and subsequently in June, Mr. Obama announced that he would start bringing American forces home, leaving security duties to the Afghans by 2014. In 2017, President Donald J. Trump said that he would continue to prosecute the war. In February of 2020, the Trump administration signed an agreement with the Taliban with the goal of reducing violence as the Taliban pledged to cut ties with terrorist groups and called for the withdrawal of American forces by May 1, 2021, a date which Biden later extended. According to the New York Times, quote, "The primary objectives of the 2020 deal were for Afghan leaders and the Taliban to negotiate a political roadmap for new government and constitution, reduce violence, and ultimately forge a lasting ceasefire," unquote. The Pentagon reports that the militants did not honor the pledges to reduce violence or cut ties with terrorist groups. The campaign by the Taliban to recapture Afghanistan started earlier this year. Some rural outposts surrendered to the Taliban and after a few months, Mr. Biden said, quote, "Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country," unquote. During the takeover, some private militias were mobilized as well as volunteer militias, many of which were armed and financed by the government. After the Taliban had taken power in Kabul, the New York Times reported that, quote, "The Taliban said that they would ensure order and public safety and that they were seeking relations with other global powers, including Russia and China, in part to receive economic support," unquote.
Afghanistan was already facing a serious humanitarian crisis, but now the economy in Afghanistan is under immense pressure, affecting countless Afghan people. According to an article by the BBC, quote, "The economy was already extremely fragile, heavily dependent on aid. A nation is considered aid dependent when 10% or more of its gross domestic product comes from foreign aid. In Afghanistan's case, about 40% of its GDP was international aid, according to the World Bank," unquote. Countries such as the US and Germany had been sending foreign aid to the country, which, along with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, since the Taliban takeover, has been withdrawn.
After the Taliban had taken over the presidential palace, thousands fled to the borders or the international airport in Kabul. On August 26th, 180 people were killed in a suicide attack, 13 of whom were American troops. The American troops had originally been meant to withdraw from Afghanistan on August 31st after President Biden declared the United States had accomplished its mission there. 650 troops were supposed to be left behind to secure the embassy in Kabul, but the Taliban were able to forcibly take the embassy and control the streets of Kabul with gunmen. In Kabul, said gunmen reportedly went door to door in search of any supporters of the government or of the American effort.
The Taliban is currently led by Habibullah Akhundzada, a religious leader from, quote, "the Taliban's founding generation," unquote. He was made leader in 2016 when Mullah Akhtar Mansour, the preceding leader, was killed in a U.S. airstrike in Pakistan. The Taliban takeover is largely affecting women in Afghanistan in many spheres. Although the Taliban has vowed to uphold women's rights despite its largely negative history toward women, this is already not seeming to be the case. According to an article by AP News, quote, "Older generations remember the Taliban's previous rule, when they largely confined women to their homes, banned television and music, and held public executions," unquote. Since the takeover, the Taliban has said that they would respect women's rights in accordance with Islamic law. However, it has been over 20 years since the Taliban were in power, and previously the Taliban did not allow women access to work or education, leaving many to question if this oppression will remain or if they will respect women's rights. According to an article by The Guardian, when the Taliban seized Kabul, a group of militants came to a woman named Shogafa's work and commanded all women home. She said, quote, "They hadn't even taken all the city, but they came to our headquarters. The manager called an emergency meeting and they told all women to leave," unquote. She has now lost her job and was the main source of income for her family, so her and roughly 50 other women went to protest their right to work at the government building, but were removed. A spokesman for the Taliban, Zabihullah Mujahid, spoke to BBC stating that, quote, "Our security forces are not trained in how to deal with women, how to speak to women for some of them." Mr. Mujahid said, "Until we have full security in place, we ask women to stay home," unquote. However, for many women, this order to remain at home is reminiscent of previous Taliban treatment of women, despite the Taliban's claim that the order is temporary. That was our audio essay on the Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. We understand that this has been extremely simplified and we're missing a lot of information, but we hope that you have gained somewhat of a deeper understanding of the current situation in Afghanistan. We've got a short break now, but stay tuned because our resource list is coming up.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM. That was Bout de Toi by NMN, followed by Easier by Sorry Girls. Now it's time for our resource list. First up, we have Women for Afghan Women, WAW. To quote their site, over the past two decades, Women for Afghan Women has grown from a small network of volunteers to become the largest women's organization in Afghanistan. Today, WAW has expanded to provide life-changing services, education, and vocational training for our clients across Afghanistan and in the United States who have endured rights violations. The key to our enduring impact is that WAW always hires locally and uses a bottom-up approach, local knowledge, and a deep understanding of and sensitivity to local culture, traditions, customs, and challenges, unquote. WAW describes their mission, quote, Women for Afghan Women is a grassroots civil society organization dedicated to protecting and promoting the rights of disenfranchised Afghan women and girls in Afghanistan and New York. In particular, WAW works to help Afghan women and girls exercise their rights to pursue their individual potential to self-determination and to representation in all areas of life, political, social, cultural, and economic. WAW relentlessly advocates for women's rights and challenges the norms that underpin gender-based violence to influence attitudes and bring about change, unquote. And their vision, quote, Women for Afghan Women is committed to working towards a world in which Afghan women and girls enjoy peace, justice, equality, and the freedoms to participate in all spheres of life and live without fear. Women for Afghan Women envisions a world in which all women and their families thrive and prosper, unquote. Check out womenforafghanwomen.org for educational purposes, or you can donate through the donate section on the page to help Afghan women and girls at present. According to an article by the Globe and Mail, quote, Canada is set to resettle 5,000 Afghan refugees as part of a U.S.-led effort to help clear American and allied bases, unquote. Further, quote, an estimated 100,000 plus refugees have been airlifted out of Afghanistan by the U.S., Canada, and other allied nations since August 1st. Unquote. Here in Canada, there are many ways we can help aid. Canada.ca outlines how you can, quote, email contact@afghanresettlement.ca to connect with Canadian refugee resettlement agencies providing support to Afghan refugees. Next up, we have Miles for Migrants. To quote their site, Miles for Migrants is a 501 non-for-profit charity formed in September 2016. Our mission is to use donated airline miles and money to book flights to fly displaced persons separated by conflict and persecution to safe new homes, unquote. They're currently working with many other non-for-profits in aiding Afghan people fleeing the country. You can donate directly through their site at milesformigrants.org for the number not spelled out. Next up, we have the International Rescue Committee, IRC, who have been aiding Afghanistan for over 30 years. To quote their site, plagued by decades of violent conflict and natural disasters, Afghanistan has created one of the largest refugee populations in the world. The IRC provides humanitarian relief and recovery assistance to those affected by crisis, unquote. Their site also details, quote, in recent years, the IRC has become one of the leaders in women's protection and empowerment in the country. As Afghanistan struggles to recover from ongoing conflict, natural disasters, and COVID-19, the IRC provides uprooted families with tents, clean water, sanitation, and other basic necessities, supports over 100 health facilities, installs hand washing stations in local communities, and provides information and training sessions about COVID-19, provides safe learning spaces in rural areas, helps people find employment, and works with local communities to identify, plan, and manage their own development projects. In the U.S., we resettle Afghan refugees with housing, employment, healthcare, education, and other comprehensive services, unquote. Please check it out at rescue.org and donate if you're able to. That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out those resources and we'll see you next Tuesday. Finishing off the episode, we've got some music starting with Si Je Pleure by Vanille, followed by Sunspots by Body Wash. Thank you.
Sarah's excited to celebrate her birthday at a restaurant. She's thought about it all week. She invited her friends. She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Jojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR, reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Jojaake's indigenous language on CKUT.
Gwe gwe gana sa da ge hrona. Onare giga za wa da hun sa da. Onska da wa nyawar yu di stok wa re onska FM. Ii ne da ha swa te ta. Da nu ii na wa hni di yo. Da nanare giga an jad jad deri an da tsaar ni di niu gini gwen yo. Nane o gara su an o ho da a ya gini gara da du uan wa ni za ra da. Nane tunu an tka jera ta ni za wa hni di yo wa tkun ho ra di yu wa za di za gunga. Da na a ya wa ski a gwe gwa ska na ga.